everyone, you know, wants their little piece of property, right? And mm-hmm. and the thing is that in our political system, you know, once you get that bit of property, right, the status quo starts to benefit you, like even in small ways and everything. Are homeowners ruining the world, Austin?
Oh gosh, it's a tough question.
You've recently bought yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I own a home, and right. You know, by no means am I a wealthy private landowner. But oh gosh, I don't. It's tricky.
But you don't want to see property taxes go up any more than they do. Right. And even right. if you personally, like, even if, you know, I'm not sort of saying that like every homeowner has like, you know, awful reactionary politics or that they mm-hmm. can't sort of set it aside and everything. But the point is that most don't. Right. And yeah. most like shouldn't even be expected to, like, it's literally become their class interest. Right. To see contained within that is a guarantee. Right. That, you know, the most engaged part of the electorate is a group of people that have married their interests to low property taxes, you know, regressive, you know, revenue structures, all these sorts of things, right? Whether or not it's really in their interest or not, they immediately begin to take on the voting characteristics of the bourgeoisie, right?
Yeah.
And there's this article we linked to in the show notes last week by Alex Yablon, and he sort of returned to it this last week, now looking back on the New York mayoral election, and sort of pointing out that, you know, what he'd predicted and what we were talking about, which was that, you know, in New York, especially in local elections, the homeowners decide. Right. And that's the reason that you saw Eric Adams, you know, walk away with that election is mm-hmm. because in New York City, like in all local politics, the property holders are more likely to vote, you know, and they're more likely to vote because they understand correctly that. God damn it. I've got a cat in the litter box. But the homeowners understand. Hold on.
You can edit it out.
No, I'm going to leave it. I'm going to, and we're going to cold open with it. With my cat scratching in the litter box. I'm going to be in this thing, and then all of a sudden we're going to let it break, and then we'll go into the intro. Like you point out, you're not like a wealthy person, you know, but there's all these sort of like downstream, you know, things that you or the other homeowners, you know, benefit from, but they just as well might, but they can also get taken to the cleaners, right? Like they did in 2008, you know, they can have it all sort of ripped out from underneath them, you know, as well, because I'm not arguing that the capital contained in people's homes makes people, you know, capitalists, you know, I acknowledge that that's an illusion, right? That it's not actual wealth. It's not, you know, but that illusion is enough to get people to kind of support this whole other, mm-hmm. you know, agenda, right? Yeah. Which is partially in their benefit, right? That in sort of their micro of it, they're like, okay, well, I don't want to pay more property taxes or whatever. But but if you're like in that mindset, right, of like, mm-hmm. oh, I don't want to pay more property taxes, then what else are you not wanting to see happen? You're not wanting to see a whole range of different policies be taken on because, you know, because you see yourself as an up and coming person with money, you know, or just somebody who's going to have to, you know, pay more property taxes if there's a property tax hike. And I'm grappling with that right now, especially because I think that organizing renting people seems mm-hmm. to make a lot of sense, you know?
Yeah. At the end of the day, I think people are entitled to housing. And I don't want to defining that term housing, like in that statement obviously points to like, yeah, people are entitled to, or should be entitled to public housing basically as a human right. 100%. But you know, in my own circumstances, you know, we were in a position where, I was basically able to get a rural home loan, and in that instance, we didn't have a down payment, which was really nice. And it just required one of us to have good credit, but not everyone has good credit because, you know, they're in debt for whatever, medical bills, yada yada yada. It's just, and that's a flaw of the system. So yeah, I mean, I have issues with private property. Conceptually, you know, a family that makes $120,000 combined or whatever, them owning property, private property, I mean, it's the same thing as a rich person owning private property. But for me, like, when we're talking about this within capitalism, the bigger issue I have is someone, you know, who owns substantial private interests, you know, and we have a shit ton of homeless people on the street in Los Angeles, you know, that sort of thing. So, and that's my problem with it.
I think there's a difference between home ownership in the context of capitalism, having a right to dwell somewhere,
yeah.
right? And having a right to have a space that is, that you have like sovereignty and autonomy over and within, right?
Yeah.
But that's kind of one thing. And that's much older than capitalism or home ownership or even the idea that, you know, you're back when property rights came from God, right? You know, I mean, yeah, like you could come move somebody around if you wanted to, you know, you just move a peasant. But in general, there was kind of like there was a notion of the commons, right? That mm-hmm. you know, if you weren't a property holder, and who the hell was, you know, that you had to exist somewhere, and that it's this process of enclosure takes the peasants and forces them, you know, to sort of live within these yeah. property ownership yeah. structures, right? And instead of living out in the unenclosed commons, whatever, right, they're now, you know, either forced to, you know, rent and become tenants, you know, or to move to the city. But the concept that people have, you know, the right to exist somewhere is pre-capitalist and post-capitalist, but it's definitely not something that exists,
yeah.
you know, in this system. And I think yeah. I think home ownership is a part of that complex, right? And it incentivizes people to think and feel like they have stake in the capitalist sure. structure of things
sure.
when, you know, when in reality, yeah, you can get taken to the, you know, to the cleaners on your home loan. If the, you know, if the economy tanks or the people who own your loan need to liquidate
right.
it and,
yeah.
you know, and it's, you know, it's all a lie, right.
Yeah.
But it affects voting patterns in a way that can literally be shown, you know, empirically. People who own homes can pretty reliably vote within a certain standard deviation of each other, mm-hmm. and renters don't.
A large portion of Asia at some point in the 21st century is going to have to grapple with their own definition of property as sea levels rise and the largest refugee crisis in the history of the world takes place, and billions, literally billions of people are uprooted and have to move within a short period of time. So, I mean, where is all the public housing going to exist when that happens? Like the infrastructure for building the public housing for that has to be happening now, and it's not. So, and that's the telling thing. That, I mean, that right there is the foreshadowing. 100%, you know, of how this is going to play out. Where's it at? Where's the public housing that should be being built right now for what's going to be the biggest refugee crisis in the history of the world? It doesn't exist, and it won't exist until it happens. They're going to let these people fucking die. It's just what's going to happen.
Right. In a century or two, I think historians will look back on the conflicts in the Middle East and the various sort of refugee crises that have developed out of that, and they will look at how utterly inept and inadequate our response was to what, you know, what is going to be the major theme of upheaval during climate catastrophe.
Right. And I know it sounds scary, and it's like this really big concept that is like hard to grasp because, number one, it's like so far off in the future, you know, and you're going to be 70 by that time, whatever. But the point is like, okay, well, when it happens, there's going to be, you know, families with 4, 5, 6 year olds that they're trying to, you know, help survive who are going to die because the infrastructure, the resources were not given to them to move, you know. And then there no one's going to take the time to educate as the human population continues to explode. I mean, more and more people are going to pop up along coastlines all around the world, and it's going to be horrific, absolutely horrific. And we're not far away. We're not far away. I mean, we're 20, 30 years from this happening.
I think it's important, and it's something that we kind of try to keep at the center of this show, for people to start to operationalize their politics around that, around the criminalization of climate refugees, right? That if you sort of start to orient your politics around that experience and the world that needs to or should exist to mitigate the suffering of those groups of people,
right,
that there's a lot that's going to kind of snap into place for you. And I think that that's, you know, you often kind of will just bewilder somebody who's really engaged in politics by being like, okay, what about domestic politics in the United States is going to help, you know, a Bangladeshi climate refugee, right? And yeah. And one of the conclusions that I think is kind of inescapable is that the best thing that could happen for climate refugees is if the nations and international institutions that will criminalize them for being refugees, if those institutions and states are as weak as possible.
Yeah. And a point that I like to bring up that I found, I still to this day find like actually fascinating, a really kind of striking moment in Democratic Party politics is, I don't remember which debate it was, but it was during the 2016 primary and Bernie and Hillary were debating. And I think they both literally brought up how it's incredibly likely that terrorism is going to spike because of climate change and stuff like that. And like, you know, neoliberals and conservatives and Republicans in that crowd, they all kind of laughed and said, that's crazy. And I'm like, nope. Like, that, I mean, we're talking about issues with terrorism now. I mean, just like when the global situation is that much worse in 40 years, like terrorism is going to be tenfold, if not more. It's especially in places like Southeast Asia, where we don't really talk about terror right now, but it will exist. There a vacuum will be created for that sort of environment to just to be created. So,
right, and I think that is a part of you know, it's a part of the climate change piece, and I think it's also a part of the subordination of states to private power and private actors. And I think that's what we're seeing in Haiti right now, right? We have a existing global international market of people who will execute heads of state for pay. Yeah. And that is, I think, like you're saying, a symptom of where we're headed, right? And I think that climate change will exacerbate it, right? That this sort of breakdown...
I wouldn't even use the word exacerbate. Right. I mean, it's just going to...
But this breakdown, particularly in the global south, right, will... The terms of that deteriorating situation will be settled by these types of actors, right? The types of actors that assassinated President Moise.
How many deteriorating situations will the U.S. try to, quote, intervene in, you know, in the global south in the future that are in these deteriorating situations being as a result of climate change? The historical precedent is there for us to do that, so...
Haitian President Jovenel Moïse was assassinated in the early morning hours of July 7th. And since then, the country has descended into chaos, as one might imagine. The legislature, which has been broken for a while in Haiti, isn't in a position to act. And as of right now, a group of about four people, the main person of whom, right, the main person of whom was appointed just days before the assassination of President Moise, are now attempting to regain control of the Haitian client state. And I think that that's a good sort of entry point for us. I wanted to sort of start by talking about how the press, starting on Tuesday, began to sort of subtly shift the emphasis of the coverage towards justifying and contextualizing the assassination, right? That, you know, it, as the coverage was, you know, sort of just starting to come out of Haiti, it had, you know, kind of the dimensions of, well, we're not sure, this is a developing situation and everything. And then something has become, you know, clear within the media class and the ruling class, right, that the actors in Haiti who perpetuated this assassination are probably the bourgeois elements that we would like to align ourselves with, we being the American state and its bourgeois element, right? And so... You just note this shift, right? You know, on the morning of the attack, the press is, you know, pretty hesitant to term Moise as an incompetent strongman, right? Which is now very much the posture of our press. And this shift, you know, occurring, you know, really just in the last, you know, 36 to 48 hours, which is something that's hard not to notice. And it's chilling when you think about, you know, sort of the role that the press plays and kind of preparing the American public for military intervention.
You know, for months leading up to his assassination, there were protests going on in Haiti, and the ruling class there in that region feared an uprising.
Right. Let's get into it a little bit, sort of, you know, what the situation was and has been, you know, in Haiti. The upshot of it is, you know, basically what you've described and what it always is in Latin America, right? The bourgeois element, right? Usually the whitest part of the society, you know, the most, you know, Iberian descended parts of the Latin American country, collude with outside actors of one shape or another, usually the United States, you know, to force a result out of their political apparatus, right?
Yeah.
And of course, you know, in Haiti, a country that's been on the short end of the stick since before the Monroe Doctrine, has been kept poor and subservient by U.S. foreign policy. You know, we force them to, you know, pay reparations to France for having had a successful slave revolt. And of course, that being the only slave revolt furnished to us by history, occurring just off the shores of the slave state that was the United States at that time, was cause for apprehension, right? And their politics have essentially been the plaything of the American state, you know, ever since, right? We waged a bloody occupation for two decades in the early 20th century and deposed and installed puppets in their politics ever since. Our military has been there three times in the last 100 years. And so into that, we introduce, a very weak and besieged state. And I think that it's there that that has to be the entry point into understanding what's being described now as, you know, gang and street violence, right? Mm-hmm. Which I think is really sort of a fascinating thing to bring up at this point, right? Because what happens, you know, when states are weak is that social organizations begin to pop up that perform the role of the state, where it can't actually project power itself. These end up being described by states and law enforcement apparatus, you know, as gangs, right? As sort of like a pejorative. The Taliban, if they weren't on the tip of the spear, are a gang, right? You know, mm-hmm. they're an administrative body that exists, you know, in an illegal capacity because the state can't project power effectively into a locality. Right. That's all a gang is on the south side of Chicago. That's what the Taliban is. And that's what the groups, you know, coalescing under Jimmy Chérizier are to represent. Right. And so you have to kind of like be willing to step back from sort of the when you hear the word gang in this situation, you're supposed to write them off, right? As just like, as the rabble, right? As the beast at the gate, you know, who Madison and Hamilton and everybody who stood in fear of the Trump protesters, back in January, right? This is the thing that they fear, right? Is the rabble, the great beast, right? The people, getting it in their heads that they can, of their own will, affect political change, right? And so we have to kind of like, you know, be willing to understand that when you hear the American press say, oh, gangs are running the streets in Haiti, it's like, okay, well, that's a condition that we ought to expect from, you know, a puppet client state that we have just run by whim and fiat for over a century, right? And that mm-hmm. the result of that is a weak state that struggles to project power into the localities. And when that's on a good day. Right. And so now that system has been thrown into disarray. And within that, right, we have what you've kind of introduced for us is this actually distinctly anti-bourgeois street movement, right, in Haiti that is now sort of starting to take shape in response to this assassination. An assassination which no doubt was hatched by the bourgeois elements of Haiti to curb the uprising, or the fear of an uprising amongst the underclass.
Yeah, the Jacobin article, I don't know if we've linked this in our show notes, but the person they interview in the article, who is the English language editor of Haiti's Liberté, the working hypothesis is that mercenaries, this is what Jackman says here, more than likely were hired by one or a consortium of bourgeois families who were opposed to Moïse.
Well, and that's been, you know, sort of the shape of it.
Yeah.
And Haiti, of course, you know, being a, you know, a former French colony and not, you know, sort of in that sphere, but very much subject to the same, you know, conditions, right, has had this very particular, you know, path of development that, you know, has resulted in, you know, a society where even, you know, the ruling class, you know, cannot come up with a bargain to keep control over the public, right? Which is normally the case, right? In most post-colonial societies, at least in the stable ones. And so, we have to understand it in that context. And I also wanted to sort of emphasize something else that they brought up in the Jacobin article, which is that the peasantry, right, of Haiti has been driven into the cities by the same forces that have always driven peasants into the cities, right, which is the inability to compete in one way or another with the forces of industrial agriculture, right? In the case of Haiti, it's what the case has been throughout Latin America, which is that small farmers in underdeveloped countries cannot compete on a global goods market. You can't, if you're growing a crop, as a peasant, right, you're not going to be able to sell that crop at the same price that it's sold for on these global markets, right? And so this, you've had all of these people driven into the cities by, these forces of neoliberalism, who now form what we can basically call, sort of a lumpen proletariat in the classical sense, right? We have a urban proletariat that is not industrialized, right? And certainly not organized into, labor unions. And and that it's these groups of people, people who have very little options, otherwise, who are, ending up in these organized criminal
ruling class in Haiti is just terrified because there's a shit ton of them and they have a shit ton of guns. So that's why they're scared. So because they don't have the firepower to stop something like that if it really took off.
Right. So, and I think that this is sort of, certainly where we, wanted to kind of arrive on this topic, which is that, along with this change in tone from the U.S. press is this sort of tacit understanding that the state and institutions in Haiti will not be able to put a lid on this issue. And I think that that is what is paving the way for yet another, a fourth U.S. military intervention in Haiti in a little more than a century.
Whenever we talk about events like this, I just like always think to myself, I want a time machine to just go sit in the sky 60 years from now and just observe what ended up happening, part of me wouldn't even want to know the answer to that.
Yeah.
Because it terrifies me.
Well,
that much.
And the thing that I want to sort of draw into this that I haven't seen people do a whole lot of is that we have kind of, a tense situation in Cuba right now. And
yeah. Yeah.
We have people in Florida, who would very much like to see, the United States impose a similar type of order in Cuba as they would like to see, as the Haitians, or at least certain elements of Haitian society would like to see imposed there. And I think I think that that's chilling. I think that when the Democrats eat shit in the next two elections, that the situation will be ripe in the Caribbean for the United States to do some adventure. And I think we'll see it. Richard Branson went to space last week.
He did.
Throw that up there. We've talked about the oceans rising, the deteriorating geopolitical situation in the traditional sphere of American influence. 107 people are dead from a heat wave in Oregon, but the Virgin Galactic owner Richard Branson is going to space mostly just for funsies.
Yeah. So Dan Riffle on Twitter tweeted, congrats to Richard Branson on going to almost space in a plane, thus adding to the long list of billionaire achievements that are really just mediocre versions of cooler things we already did decades ago through collective endeavor financed by taxes. Next, you're going to be telling me that Elon Musk is building a transit tunnel with dramatically lower throughput than New York City's 100-plus-year-old subway system.
These are the Mycenaean ruins sticking up out of the dust, and our Homeric Richard Branson is just coming up with new myths to describe how they were done. And I think I think you're right. I think that's the right take, is that this is just the decline.
It's not just the decline on space, or I just Freudian slip. It's not just the decline on Earth. It's all we're witnessing the ruling class's realization, you know, that the writing is on the wall here. So now it's time to move on to the final frontier, which we will also ruin. And that's what's happening.
This is my favorite thing about, you know, what Richard Branson's talking about and about sort of like what the PR line is, you know, because you can tell they're kind of self-conscious about it. And they're talking about making space more accessible to everyone, right? Like as though what the real project here is, you know, is that, and it's like, you could make that argument.
AKA, we're making it more accessible for more rich right. people to go up
well,
there.
Well, and you know, to the extent that rich people will want to go there, it will just be for the sake of exploitation of one resource or another. And this is kind of what I'm getting is, it's sort of the chilling implication that we will come up with a reason to go there. Right. And I, you know, people might wonder at my use of the word chilling. Every job and existence that will exist out there will be hell and will be performed by people who are effectively slaves, right? People who've been, you know, from the, at the moment at which, you know, there's any, you know, demand for a normal person to go to space, that person
can't
will
quit
go
your job
there.
Out there and go back that easily.
That person, as soon as there's a reason for normal people to go to space, there will be slaves in space. There will be indentured servants on mining freighters in Elon Musk's, you know, space navy, right? And and because that's what it implies. Right, when you talk about making space accessible, is you're implying
that
there will
be? What are you talking about? Elon Musk, they're not going to be slaves. He's going to make sure they have roller coasters in the spaceships that they can all be happy on.
Right. It'll be a space.
Who cares about being able to collectively bargain and have workers' rights and shit like that? Like this is they're going to have roller coasters, dude. And one of them, he might have a competition for 100,000 workers where one of them wins a Tesla in space, dude. I mean, come on.
Well, and I suspect that
that's a great working environment.
I suspect that we'll never get to the point, you know, where labor in space is actually being, like, menial labor is actually being done by human beings in space. It's too expensive. Yeah. So what I'm doing there is taking them at their word that they plan for normal people to go to space, right? Which I think taking them even at their word is chilling, but what we know will likely be the reality is that, you know, only professionals and specialists will ever go there, and people, you know, rich enough to have a need to go, right? And everybody else will just be here.
Those rich enough to pay so they can go scout the asteroid belt to figure out, oh, I'm going to, you know, mine this section of the asteroid belt.
Well, or, you know, when the bourgeois, you know, parts of the North Atlantic face the same conditions that the bourgeois elements of Haiti face, they'll have this set of options available to them, right? To, you know, to get out before shit really hits the fan.
I mean, the other thing that I might be reaching out on, like, a limb here, think, like, I don't know, I'm postulating this, but it's like, you know, are we witnessing or have we potentially witnessed a blueprint for this happening to other leaders everywhere in the world in, you know, the coming decade? And that's,
I think that what we're going to see a lot of places that we consider to be sovereign countries turned into flags of convenience for, you know, multinational. So it'll be Singapore brought to you by Exxon, right? That what you'll end up with is you're going to end up with sort of states that are, you know, entirely sponsored and directed by multinationals, right? And those will, you know, impose themselves.
That's how the final frontier is going to end up. Countries aren't going to own planets. Yep. It's going to be corporations, 100%.
And that's something.
United States is not going to own Pluto. Like, that's not going to happen. It's going to be, you know, some. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it'll be Jeff Bezos's Blue Origin or whatever the fuck his space company is called. So